It's remarkable these days how often I hear about the need for mental health services. We all lived through the incredible pandemic, didn't we? And all the complications that it seemed to hold on people's psyches and souls and family life in general. And some of it even had some positive and adaptive features. But for the most part, I, as a therapist, I'm amazed at the number of people who have been profoundly rattled and affected by that experience in their life. And I think it's probably going to be many years before we can fully evaluate the significance of that. And so more and more, this desire for mental health services, in particular, this idea of mental health expertise that can address the devastating pain that comes with anxiety and depression and broken relationships and the profound fear of the unknown and the uncertain seem to be driving us more and more as we move along in the culture. And this, of course, parallels the historical issue that people have always carried with us, at least that I'm aware of in my life, the need to wonder who we are, truly are, the need to have a sense of what's my purpose, why am I here, what's the significance or relevance of that, and to believe that if I could find that answer, if something could crystallize for me, then I would find a way to feel fed. So this idea seems to be permeating our culture. And my profession has had remarkable research and growth and, in the past, certainly in the past 10 years, but really in the past 75 years as we've learned so much more about how the brain functions and how both external and internal dynamics, physically, emotionally, intrapsychically, are affecting what's happening to us. We kind of continue to hear the old historical wisdom about how important it is to step away from the past traumatic events and to live in the present. And then somehow in doing that, maybe we will have an easier time anticipating the future. So those things are the messages that we seem to be getting in our culture. But I guess as part of my nature, living for 70 years, I want to throw a little cold water on all of that perspective. I think that while there is truth to what I've just echoed, I think there are distortions that are coming from that that are really helping us and harming us and helping us to become more confused. And, you know, one of the most frequently echoed cultural war crimes is follow the science. I'm thinking of a particular commercial now where we're watching the behavior of pets and all the, you know, the joy that they bring this particular family. And they're talking, I guess, about their food supply. And in broad letters, it talks about how science did that. And so this recognition that that science doing that is really a recapitulation of the Enlightenment, which we seem to be in earnest pursuing once again after our horrendous experience in the 19th and 20th centuries. You know, you may remember, some of us are not into history these days or those perspectives, but you may remember that, you know, that the Enlightenment was a discovery that that apart from what religious brought us, which was essentially a kind of neuroses, it would claim. We had elevated reason to the elite and to the masses in different ways, and that this new wisdom, this new intellectual pursuit would allow us to solve problems, because after all, most problems are man-made. And so the solutions need to be man-made. And I remember President Kennedy's address literally using those very words. Okay. But the 20th century had over 200 million deaths attributed directly and indirectly to this concept that God, if he existed, needed to be on the periphery, and that that man was fully and completely in charge of his destiny. Okay. Why is that? Why would we worry about those things? You know, when we have all of the solutions available to us through the human brain, why would we worry about death and petulance and war and disease and famine and injustice? Okay. We should be able to solve that. Okay. But can anyone claim that in our second go-around with the tenets of the Enlightenment, that we have any less injustice in the world, that we have any less betrayal, that we have a greater morality and a kinder understanding of how to address each other, that our families are stronger and wiser, or is it just the opposite? So the first thing I want to say as a therapist is that I believe in the value of therapy. But therapy is not a religion. Therapy is a process of healing in which a trained clinician may understand quite a bit about how the brain works and the significance of one's history and how certain behaviors, positive and not so positive, can be reinforced, and that all of those tenets can be used to help people heal and ultimately to grow. But none of that is likely to work if you don't have a reason for living. And it is virtually impossible, I would argue, and I know I will get some doubt about that, but I think the evidence historically is overwhelming, that purpose can only be defined when you understand that there is something or someone greater than you. For Christians, we call that not just God in the Trinitarian sense that we have come to know, but we are guided by the person of Jesus Christ, fully human, yet in mystical ways we can't comprehend, is the Alpha and the Omega. The light and the life that we so desperately need. So once we identify this part of our life first, we can begin to take a look at a direction in our life and can begin to orient strategies to address psychological pain and loss and transition in our life with some perspective. But without a personal God, when the burden falls completely on us, then I think what we see is an incredible level of tension. And I certainly could see it in my own clinical work. The people who really did not believe, were agnostic, or at best, you know, sort of marginally involved with the idea of God, were particularly paralyzed emotionally by the pandemic, because their existence that could be snuffed out seemingly in this concrete way, you know, we're logical and realistic, we understand that our mortality can be and will be stuffed out at some point, you know, in our life. But we feel like if we have this illusion of control, we're okay. And the idea that we had this virulent disease that nobody really knows, even to this day, the true etiology of it and the power of it and, you know, what's going to be coming in eventually behind it and all of those things have really shaken people to the core. You know, so how do we trust in this gift of life? How do we, you know, begin to place value in that life? Okay. So I think we've become, unfortunately, less likely to walk into our houses of worship, less likely to read with a sense of discipline and to pray and to reflect on Holy Scripture, you know, to even really contemplate, you know, what's the relevance of holiness to me, you know, because we all know our own humanness too well and our struggles to mirror Christ as a disciple, as an ambassador for him. So I find that that there are, in many ways, two types of patients or clients that I see. One are the, I would classify, not so much as, you know, they're progressive or conservative or Christian versus non-Christian or believers versus atheist or agnostic, but people who really see themselves in the broadest sense of the word as human beings versus people who have a sense about them, even if they haven't crystallized it verbally, that they're better thought of or conceived of as human becomings. So many of the people who I come in are concerned about holding on to their sanity or their creativity or their affluence, or their marriage, or their careers, all of which, by the way, are incredibly important things. They're not trivial things. But this sense of, you know, the sense of being is that I possess these things. I own these things. And I've got to protect them from something or someone that might affect them. Versus the people who I see who have an intuitive sense. Maybe they're in a 12-step program of recovery and have been humbled by powerlessness and unmanageability in their life. Maybe they've faced profound trauma and loss in their life in some way or an impact on their health and vitality. And so they begin through this process of authentic humility to cultivate a sense of gratitude for the gifts and the experiences that they do have. And they begin to look and see, you know, what more can they understand about this remarkable journey that they're on for however long that they're on. So they see themselves as becomings gradually, but persistently growing. That life without a sense of growth is a very boring place. And I don't take that word too lightly. If you were to ask me numerically what's the chief presenting complaint I get as a therapist, they might use different words, but their primary word is boredom. People have a sense of emptiness because they've been convinced that happiness was something that they were entitled to and that happiness was really about experiencing peak experiences, you know, that brought a lot of adrenaline and fun and joy. And I hope there aren't too many people that don't, you know, enjoy those things. But the much deeper sense of happiness is contentment. It's finding a sense of belonging. It's finding the deepest sense of belonging, which is purpose in our life. So when we don't have that sense of purpose, we can get very confused. You know? So if I were going to sort of sum up my attitude as a human being, as a therapist, I'm going to reach into, you know, one of the great works of literature. I say somewhat sarcastically, you know, but a profound moment in a movie called Rocky Balboa. And I don't know how many have seen that. It's probably the least familiar to people. But this was Rocky as he's about to touch 60, I suspect, in the character. He's a widower. He's running a restaurant in his late wife's name. And his son is particularly concerned as Rocky's starting to have his own existential thoughts about, you know, what do I want to do and what can I do? And he's thinking about fighting again, and he's actually given some offer by some promoter. And so they have a confrontation on the street in which Rocky hears his son talk about how he feels like he's been a shadow, that whenever anybody saw him, they saw Rocky, not him. And, you know, and he didn't want to be a shadow, and he resented being a shadow, and he was hurt. But Rocky confronts his son, I think, in a very succinct way. And I'd like to just quickly read that piece from the movie. Yeah. And here's what he says to his son. "Let me tell you something. You already know," he says to his son. "The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place. And I don't care how tough you are. It will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward, how much you can take and keep moving forward." That scene, to me as a therapist, is a scene that I could envision growing up in my youth, my father saying to me, and most of my contemporaries, mentors saying to them. That scene would be almost unheard of today in this culture, where I think the father would be talking about the therapist they could see, or the medications that seemed to help his friend, or the job opportunities that might change his economic plight, or the family business offers that might be made. You know, again, those things aren't intrinsically evil, but they skirt the real issue that life is hard, that it is painful, that suffering is not pathological, it is part of life, and that finding meaning in life involves finding meaning in suffering. And so simple techniques by an experienced therapist, or some chemical involvement through the use of an SSRI or other forms of psychotropic medication relief, in of themselves are not likely to change your life, and it may even be counterproductive without that spiritual core. So before you consider engaging in this very personal and beneficial relationship of therapy with anyone, you need to consider that whole issue of meaning.